All right. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning for all our viewers, wherever you are. This is Wissam Sharafuddin speaking to you from Dearborn Blog. And with me today or tonight, Dr. Sally Howell. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for including me.
Dr. Sally Howell is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and Director of the Center for Arab American Studies. Her books include Citizenship and Crisis, Arab Detroit After 9/11, 2009, Arab Detroit 9/11, Life in the Terror Decade, 2011, and Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past, 2014. Old Islam in Detroit received the 2015 Arab American Book Award from the Arab American National Museum. Howell's current research and public arts project, Halal Metropolis, explored the political, cultural, and economic impact of Muslim visibility in Detroit. We Are in This Together is an unscripted, live, nonprofit broadcast by Dearborn Blog to have conversations that become oral history records of our living lives, of our lives during the COVID-19 pandemic, also known as the coronavirus pandemic. These are personal stories of our lives during these unprecedented social isolation measures in a globalized world. The conversation continues. This is the 18th episode. We started in the beginning of March, in the mid-March almost, and now it is June 23rd. The conversation has shifted as we progress. The topics have shifted. And we continue with great guests such as Dr. Howell to reflect on our situation. So welcome again, Doctor.
Thank you. Thank you. And I've asked you to call me Sally.
Okay. So for our viewers, upon the request of
Sally.
Dr. Sally Howell, I'm going to start calling you Sally. You know, this reminds me of a story when I arrived to Dearborn for the first time in 1991, and I was a ninth grader in Fortson High School. And every time I wanted to address the teacher, I would stand up because that's the I came from back home where we stand up whenever we want to speak to the teacher. So every time I would stand up and speak, the class would crack up about this voter who keeps standing up for the teacher. And I was, I don't know, I was too strong. I was religious and I had, you know, I really wasn't affected by them laughing. And I kept doing it and addressing the teacher and they grew tired of it. And then one, you know, about the third or fourth day, the teacher told me, I forgot the name of the teacher. And he told me, Wissam, I appreciate it so much that you're standing to talk to me, but really you don't have to. Completely, you know, do not expect you to stand up for me. So I told him, may I stand up and speak to you? When I want to speak to you, I feel more comfortable. Can I stand up? And he says, yes. And I continue to stand up.
Well, I guess that in that case, rather than make you feel like a boater, I'll let you call me Dr. Howell. But
that's fine. But upon your wish, I'm going to be calling you Sally. I find it difficult, but honoring your wish is more important to me. So, Sally, we are today in June 23rd. It is not clear where we at with the pandemic. There is still so many unanswered questions. We are doing better in Michigan. Mm-hmm. We are not doing better in some other states in the country. Shutting down, opening up. So many unanswered questions, the fear of a second wave. But before we get to today, can you just reflect this? These are personal interviews, and I know you have a lot of expertise to on subjects to be, you know, talked about. But we want to focus as much as I can. I'm sure I'm going to go off tangents with you on some of the subjects that I'd love to talk to you about. But I'll try to bring myself back to this being a personal interview about you as a person in your personal life, as a human being, as a resident of this area of Earth. So how did you receive this pandemic, and how did you progress over time with with your reaction to it?
Well, I mean, I took it seriously from the beginning. I'm, you know, getting close to 60, and I have several pre-existing health conditions that make me a little bit vulnerable. More recently, I found out that type A blood also makes you like you're much more likely, you're like twice as likely to get really sick or to pass away if you're to need a respirator if you're type A blood. So that's not good. And my husband also has some health conditions that make him vulnerable. So we've been, we were just very early on being conservative with each other. I remember the last public event I attended, it was the Bernie Sanders town hall meeting the night before election night back in, was it February or March? I can't remember. It must have been March, like the very beginning of March. And I had some Iraqi students who had just come home. They're like people who graduated last year, and they were like they spent the holiday season in Iraq, and they were in Najaf and places like that. And I don't know if you recall, the virus, one of the first real sort of outbreaks outside of China was in Iran, and it was in Qom specifically, and it was spreading to Iraq. And so I remember seeing these students and being like, you know, Sally, don't shake their hands. Sally, don't shake their hands. But of course, I hadn't seen them in months. So I gave them big hugs, you know, and I immediately was worried. But that was it's just sort of crazy to think that, you know, there we were in a room full of people posing for selfies with people, you know, very excited, thinking about the election. And then that Friday, the university, you know, the university shut down on Thursday. And it was pretty clear that everything else was shutting down on Friday. Like Friday, the campus was closed, but I had a friend who was in town visiting who was working on a research project with me. And so he and I went and interviewed some people in the Yemeni community. And we shook hands with people and we both talked about it. Like in the morning, we were kind of comfortable shaking hands. And by the end of the day, because the news was progressing over the course of the day, by the end of the day, we were like, we shouldn't be shaking hands. Wow. You know, it's like, it was just, it was all, everything was changing so quickly then. But anyway, since then, I've been home. I've been, you know, the only things we do are go to the grocery store. I have one friend that I walk with and, you know, with masks and socially distanced. And I think more recently we've gotten a little bit more relaxed. Like I went to a baby shower, a friend of mine had a baby shower, but it was in a park and we were socially distanced and, you know, we had food. Everybody brought finger food so that you didn't have to share utensils and stuff like that. No hugs, no handshakes. But it's been hard. It's been hard to live in such isolation. It's not the norm for me. It's not the norm for my husband. And our daughter is on the other side of the country, which is, you know, she lives in Seattle. So she's also in a place that had an early outbreak. So she and her partner took it very seriously. So, I mean, I feel like we're doing what we can. My mom is right now she's in the hospital, but she lives in a nursing home and her facility has been very, very conservative and cautious. So like, you know, to the extent that I can be protective of the people who are closest to me, I'm doing that, but it's just hard. We don't have control over anything. It's also just hard from a professional point of view because we can't plan anything. We can't, you know, we just don't know we don't know how the rules are going to be next week. Right. We are lucky that we live in Michigan. I mean, we had a very, very bad outbreak here, specifically in the metro area. It was really bad. And a lot of our hospitals basically crashed. And, I mean, I don't know if you do, but I know many people who were ill, who were seriously injured by the disease, and several people who passed away. So it's not, you know, it's not something that I take lightly. And I have family in other parts of the country where they don't see it this way. They haven't seen, even though like most of my siblings are in North Carolina, and they're about to pass us in terms of the number of cases. But we got to, 6,200 or 6,200, whatever we are right now. We got there over 4 or 5 months. They're getting there in like 6 weeks. You know, they have, you know, well over 15 cases a day now, whereas we had over 1,500 cases a day, like 2 days. And then we dropped immediately, you know, because we just shut everything down when our numbers started spiking. Their numbers are spiking and they're opening up more.
Right.
It's kind of nerve-wracking. it's nerve-wracking that as a country we're not taking it more seriously, and that we don't have leadership. I mean, here in Michigan, I think we've got good leadership, but it's a travesty that we don't have national leadership, and that so many people are going to be sick, and that, you know, even in terms of the economy, it's going to affect the economy much worse because it's going to last longer, you know. Anyway, it's a challenging time. Let's put it that way.
Definitely, and I agree with you. And I am one of the happy citizens about the reaction of our Michigan governor. And I feel that in Michigan we have really a good handle of the situation.
Amazing job. I mean, our numbers are like around 100 new cases a day, and even with the demonstrations we have going on in Detroit right now, you know, you don't see people my age at those demonstrations. You see young people. You ordinarily at demonstrations, you would see a lot of older people, but they're not going because they're being careful.
And you see a lot of mask wearing, a lot of social.
Everyone's wearing a mask. Yeah. I mean, everybody, they're taking it very seriously. Mm. I don't think they can really socially distance, but they're trying.
I mean, it's a good thing that Detroit is so large and we have a lot of vacancies and open streets that, it wasn't really that cramped. But nevertheless, yeah, I understand. Doctor, so your college shifted online. Have you taught online courses before?
I was not teaching this semester, so alhamdulillah, I didn't have to deal with that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've never taught online. I kind of am not a big believer in online, especially with the kinds of classes I teach, which, you know, where we deal with really challenging subjects, and I ask the students to bring all of themselves to the classroom, you know, not just what they're reading, not their book knowledge, and I try to make the classroom a safe space. I think you can't necessarily do that if you're talking from your dining room table, and you know your parents are right there who might not understand what's being discussed, or you know, just where you don't really know who your fellow students are and don't have any confidence in them. But anyway, I'll be teaching two classes in the fall, both online. And so I'm trying to prepare for that right now. It's one of the things I'm doing this summer, is getting myself ready to do a good job of that in the fall.
All right. What do you feel is the most important aspect of the face-to-face teaching? You know, if someone asks in the future, you know, it's we're listening to the same lecture at our own convenience, at our own pace, in our own space. What are they missing? You know, because you might have generations that they might have never experienced a class face to face in a college. You never know.
Well,
so this message is to them.
I mean, so first off, in our pedagogy, I mean, we're being told and advised not to do lectures if you're teaching online. You know, it's not the same. It's not the same experience as a face-to-face class. So it's not so much what they call the sage on the stage, you know, the person standing and talking. One of the things I like to do in the classroom is, it's not even so much a lecture, but like we'll have something that we read in common. And then I'll sort of talk about maybe the key points of the text that we've read. But then I'll ask the students, you know, it's like a dialogue where I'll be like, okay, so what are the, you know, what is the main argument of this writer? What is the evidence the person used to make this point? Let's talk about their evidence. Is this the most effective evidence, or which pieces of evidence made the most sense to you? And then I just love to use the chalkboard. So I'll like fill up all the chalkboards in the room, just sort of detailing some of the stuff and getting the students to really participate and share. And we come up with this model of what we're reading and what's important and how it builds on the thing we read last week. You know, that's kind of my teaching style, and you can do it online, but it has a more of a perfunctory kind of thing. Whereas when you do it in the classroom, you feel like you can see people just going, oh yeah, yeah, I get it. And you also see people who disagree, like really disagreeing, you know, like having a space where they can, it's not they're not being cranky or, you know, they're not trying to provoke people. They're just trying to understand. And so you can have this kind of conversation with people where there are real disagreements, but they're not hostile. Whereas I think that we're so used to, especially from social media and stuff like that, where the things we read, sometimes they get ratcheted up and, you know, we try to outdo each other. They're competitive. in a way that the classroom, just the face-to-face thing, it doesn't have that feel.
Right. Yeah, definitely. This is a big problem with online communication, is that there is a lot that is missing that we might collect in our unconscious from body language and tone and just the whole environment, and also humanizing the other person that you're talking to. And that's all lost. It's interesting. Sometimes someone, you know, I write something and someone tells me, you know, you shouldn't be angry about this. I tell them, I wasn't angry. I was just, you know, like they felt that I was saying something angrily while I wasn't. So that's a lot of things that are lost through this online communication. So, I always, you know, tell my friends that we are a generation that have lived pre-internet and post-internet. And it seems that you, professor, are going to be one of those professors who lived the actual, the real classes and the online, the virtual classes. I hope that the shift doesn't take place completely. But there is definitely signs of that shift, I mean, that are increasing every day. And this has not helped at all. This has pushed it
pushed it. Absolutely, yeah. Pushed it.
Yeah. Schools, you know, schools are definitely not taking away virtual from their options. They cannot go back to the normal. You know, there's no going back to normal. Well, so there is a shift.
I mean, I do think that there are some institutions. Like one thing that's happening for us is because we're a commuter campus and we're sort of a smaller school, and a lot of our students work full time and it's hard for them to attend classes. So we've been, our administration has been sort of pressuring us, encouraging us to do more online teaching for the last several years. And I've just noticed, like this summer, one of the things they did was they had like an incentive. Whereas if you get two of your classes online this summer, if you prepare them for online, we'll give you a course release, you know, down there. They're trying to really incentivize, and they want the campus to be at least 50%. Like, so I'm teaching in the fall, and one of my classes has been sort of approved as an online class. I went through the curriculum and changed it to make it an online class, but the other class is going to be taught online, even though I haven't officially gotten online certification for the class yet. What they're trying to do is get online certification so that in the future, all these classes will be available online. And they're trying to make it so most of our degrees, or at least many of our degrees, can be awarded online, and so that students won't have to come to campus. And I mean, there are things that happen in this world where you start to appreciate the fact that you're older. I'm like, I don't ever want to teach all my classes online. You know, I mean, I'm going to do online this fall because for everyone's health, I totally get that we need to be online this fall. But in the winter, I hope to be back in the classroom. And next fall, I plan to be back in the classroom. So I do see that it's like, you know, the university is. They see an opening here, and they're rushing into that opening and encouraging us all to make that leap.
And we might go back with much more appreciation to that. So I feel it will increase the passion in what we have done before.
I hope so. I mean, I am a little bit. I feel like, yes, I can't wait to be doing live things. You know, as you know, I had an exhibit that was on display that got shut down, and all of our public programming got shut down, and all of the research and documentary work we were doing got shut down. And I can't wait to get back out and do it again. But I will also say that, especially because right now you see so many people, the rules aren't clear about how we engage with each other, about what social distancing means. Some people take the mask wearing more seriously than others. Like, I have a friend who's been out documenting some of the demonstrations taking place in Detroit, and he says that he went to one in Dearborn, and that the Dearborn one, everybody was like high-fiving him, and then next thing he knew, he was getting hugs, and he couldn't not, you know, if someone comes up to you and gives you a hug, you don't, you know. Anyway, so I feel like for me, I'm so nervous about all this. Like, I have my boundaries, and I have these, you know, other people have different boundaries. And I think it almost makes me feel like I must be paranoid or something to be insisting on the set of rules, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. People have different I feel like people within bubbles, they have different perception of the disease. And once, when you get in touch with these different bubbles, as if they are different universes, you know, of, yeah, of treating this disease. And it's very interesting. And you might, you know, do something, it seems ridiculous to one other bubble, while, you know, they do something and it's shocking to you. And it's, you know, the environment of doubt and, you know, the, in the midst of scientific findings and not, things are not very solid, that doesn't help too, you know, that and there's so much media involvement in marketing one research and the other and one opinion or the other. Doctor, there's two things I want to touch upon just a little bit before we go into the questions. Is first that the Arab American, the Center for Arab American Studies, that's such a special program that the University of Michigan has. Can you tell us a little bit about it? It's one of the unique programs in the country.
Well, yes. I mean, so we're in Dearborn, Dearborn, Michigan, which for those of you who don't know, has a very large Arab community. It's, you know, I think that, you know, the Los Angeles area, San Francisco, maybe New York have larger Arab American populations, but they're bigger metro areas. And neither, none of those cities has a city like Dearborn. With a, Dearborn has a population of roughly 100,000 people. And although the census tells us it's slightly less than half the population is Arab, we know that it's more than half of the population in Dearborn is actually Arab American. And then there are all these neighborhoods in the communities around Dearborn. So Melvindale, Dearborn Heights, Detroit, that have, you know, that also have large Arab American populations. So that sense of Dearborn being, you know, Arab Dearborn, I refer to it as Greater Dearborn. You know, there's Dearborn proper, and then there's Greater Dearborn, this larger Arab community that spills out to the surrounding area. And of course, there are Arabs, Arab Americans throughout the metro area. So it's a very distinctive place. And so the university wanted to sort of acknowledge that and provide some focus on the Arab American community. And so, yeah, I'm one of several faculty members. We have about 8 faculty members now who teach in the Arab American Studies Center. And we offer classes on the history of the community, sort of an overview of what is the field of Arab American studies, what do Arab Americanist scholars do. We have classes on all these history classes about the, like, the, you know, the history of Islam in America, Arab American history classes. We have classes on Islamophobia, classes on Middle Eastern diasporas, not just in the Americas, but in Europe and like Central America and North America. We have a wide variety of classes. I teach one class, it's a public history class. It's sort of like how to do public history, what's valuable about public history. And each time I teach it, I focus on a different subject. So 1 year I focused on Iraqi refugees in Detroit. The last time I taught it, I focused on Yemeni merchant marines who work on the Great Lakes. And the next time I teach it, it's a pet subject of mine. We're going to focus on the basements and garages of Dearborn. we'll be looking at vernacular architecture. But the center, so we teach classes, and our goal is to, I see it as, you know, a lot of Arab American students in Dearborn don't think that they need to take a class on Arab Americans. You know what I mean? They're like, I'm there, you know, let me tell you what it's like. Who are you? You're not an Arab anyway, you know? But I always feel like if you're going to be a medical professional and provide services for the Arab community, it's really good for you to really understand the history, the social, you know, the social history of the community, the socioeconomic status of the community, understand about the diversity of the community and how even like health conditions or mental health conditions affect different parts of the population differently. We equip people to know that, you know, we give them the tools they need to do a better job of providing services to the community. If you want to be a community leader, I also think that we really give you the tools, you know, so that you'll understand, you know, everyone grows up in their own unique experience, like what you referred to as a bubble a minute ago, you know. You know, you can be Lebanese from a certain generation and you really don't understand the Iraqi family that lives down the street from you. To you, they look exotic or strange, or the Yemeni community or something like this. So I think that we help people really understand the diversity of the Arab American experience. I also like to teach a lot with using materials from Arab Americans who grow up outside enclaves, you know, like I use Mahja Kopp's book, The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf. She grew up in Indianapolis, you know, kind of alone, the children of like a missionary family. You know, it's just such a different perspective on what it means to be Arab in America. I think our students, most of whom come from the metro area, they feel so confident in their Arabness. You know, they've not lived in a place where they've had the kind of, you know, extreme isolation and xenophobia that people get in other places. So anyway, so we empower people in those ways. And then we also try and build resources for the community. So we work with archives at the Arab American Museum and at the University of Michigan to collect the history of the community. We set students up with internships and often jobs at local institutions. You know, we work with school systems and provide them with just sort of advice and statistics and things like that on demographic patterns in the community so they can better serve the Arab American community. I mean, we're a resource to the community. And that's one of our goals as well.
Great. So one of those programs that this center has done is the Halal Metropolis, which, you know, I've had the pleasure of actually taking a few student tours to it, and it wasn't getting less interesting every time I did the tour, believe it or not. And you had great people doing the tours there. So can you also briefly tell us a little bit about this exhibit, and what is the aspirations of the center in general? And is the also the exhibit, is it going to continue during this pandemic, after the pandemic? What's the goals of it?
Yeah, so the Halal Metropolis project is it's called, you know, Halal Metropolis, Exploring Muslim Visibility in Detroit. And this focuses on the Muslim American community as a whole, not just the Arab community or not just the Arab part of the Muslim community. So it's adjacent to, or in a Venn diagram, it overlaps with the mission of the center, but it's also slightly, you know, it has a slightly different mission as well. And there are three principal curators in the project, myself, and I'm a historian, and there's a professor from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. He's an art professor, Osman Khan, who's a practicing artist who lives in Detroit. And then Razi Jaffrey, who's a documentarian, a filmmaker, and a photographer who's also working on the project. He's working with us on the Dearborn campus, but he's about to go back to school and get an MFA from Ann Arbor. So he'll be in Ann Arbor in the fall. And what we've done is we've tried to look at, it's an exhibition project, and it was imagined to be in six parts. And what we will be doing over the course of a 2-year period is traveling to six different locations. And in each location, we would tell the specific history, the specific story through art, through photography, and through historical materials, tell the story of that specific place. So for those of you who don't live in Michigan, you might be like, wow, where are they going? To San Francisco and Houston and, you know, all these different places. No, all these six places we're going to are in the Metro Detroit area, but each of them has a very different story. So we started in Detroit, and we really focused on the history of the African-American Muslim community, which, you know, goes back to the very beginning of the Muslim presence here in the city. And the Nation of Islam was established here in Detroit. You know, one of the biggest and most important mosques in the city is an African-American mosque. I mean, there's such a rich history here in terms of the Black community and their embrace of Islam, and their experience of Islam. And so we started off telling that story. Then we went to Hamtramck, which is a small sort of urban enclave that's located in Detroit, but it's very diverse. It's the only city in the country that even technically, you know, Dearborn untechnically has an Arab majority, but Hamtramck technically has a Muslim majority, but it's much more diverse than Dearborn. It's got Muslims from Bosnia, from Bangladesh, from Yemen, African-American Muslims, Syrian, Palestinian Muslims, just a diversity of different kinds of Muslims, and many of them newly arrived immigrants. So it's one of those places where the public school system, I think there are more than 20 different languages that are taught in the public schools there. So it's a real challenge. A lot of newly arrived people and people who are coming here who might not have like English before they come. You know, there's a difference. People who come with all of their skills and their degrees and they land, you know, on their feet and just start running, and people who come without skills and have to really, the parent generation really struggles to make way for the second generation to succeed. And I think you see a lot of those families in the Hamtramck community. And but anyway, so this really diverse community lives in a city that used to be overwhelmingly Polish. And so there's a real history there of how the power basically transitioned from the Polish community to these new immigrants. And even the dynamics of that community today are still very, you know, it's everything in the city is contested. And so it's interesting to watch. So we tell the story of Hamtramck, and we tell that through, you know, through objects and through newspaper stories and things like that. But we also tell it by showing the clothing that people wear on the streets in Hamtramck, and by doing portraits of people in the city and all sorts of things. So then we went to Howell, Michigan, which is a far distant suburb, where we were sort of like, are there Muslims in Howell, Michigan? We didn't think there were, but we found out that there's a Sufi Zawiya out there. It's called The Farm, and it's a Naqshbandi mosque, and it's got a really thriving community, and it's contributed quite a bit to the visibility of Islam out in that area. This place is also near Camp Dearborn, which you might know. Have you ever been to Camp Dearborn?
Yes.
I've never been. I'm ashamed to say I've never been to Camp Dearborn. But there are a lot of like Arab Americans in particular who are hunters and outdoors people who, you know, fish and hunt out in that area. So we documented them. There are also a lot of converts to Islam who grew up in that area, who are sort of white, middle-class, suburban people who became Muslim. And now they're like our horsewomen, and they still do horseback riding and they show horses, and but they wear hijab. Or one woman is like a hunter out in the woods with her bright orange hijab on, you know, it's kind of cool. Wow. So we documented some of those things. And then the fourth installation was in Dearborn, where we tell the story of Dearborn. And we were shut down. So we had two more installations left. We were supposed to go to Macomb County. And I was really eager to go out there because the story there is one where I think there's a long history of Muslim inhabitation in Macomb County, but not one of Muslim visibility, because this area is very much known for its anti-Black racism. And it's, you know, it's Islamophobia, it's xenophobia. And that is a history that is still changing, but it's like whenever someone tries to open a mosque in that area, there is just this real outpouring of hate that the community has to get past in order to just be able to do mundane things like pray in a mosque. So that was going to be a challenge for us to find a way to tell that story without, you know.
How is the reaction, Sally, to the exhibits? Are you satisfied with the community response to these exhibits, or are you disappointed, or it's just it met your expectation?
Well, you always want more people to attend. Mm-hmm. You always want a bigger audience. I think in you know, it's sort of interesting. Everywhere we've been, we've kind of hit capacity, and like mm-hmm. the opening events have been just packed houses and maybe more people than we expected, and people have been happy and enthusiastic. so it's been good in that sense. But we also do these like gallery events where we have these conversations in the gallery with activists or artists or community leaders from that community. And we're trying to talk about really complex issues. And for some of them, we've had, we just haven't had a good turnout. I'm like, wait a minute, these are more fun than anything we do. Come, you guys, come. but what can I say? It's like a new thing. And now we kind of have a following, but in the beginning we had to build up that audience. But I think in terms of people's reaction to the show, I think it's been really, really rewarding and satisfying for us as a team, because I think people really get what we're trying to do. And it's not like we don't we don't have too much of an architecture of telling you what to think. We just kind of lay out some things and let you draw your own conclusions. And I know that when we first were doing it and talking about our vision for it and how we were going to create it, the historian in me, you know, the teacher in me was a little bit like, but we have to give more. We have to give more, you know, but my partner sort of held me back a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's the most satisfying thing is seeing people go in and start looking in the cases, and everybody finds something different to latch onto, something different to just love. Right. And I think that it's been true for every single one. And that honestly, it's been very satisfying because, you know, we're just three people. We have some, you know, other people who are working with us, but there's so much that we have to be missing, but people aren't resenting us for what we're missing. They're appreciating us for what we get right. So I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah. I mean, two messages I wanted my students to and I had, you know, over 100 go through the exhibit. I wanted them to first of all, okay, understand the importance of their history and how it interprets, and they can see their presence from it, and they can also foresee some future because of it. But also I wanted them to understand the importance of recording history, how this history is pieced together, and this great effort of a few curators of collecting all these pieces of letters and papers and pictures and documents and meeting minutes, and how it's important for them to document. And I actually had like an after assignment for them is to go do an interview with their oldest relative present and document their history, you know. And I told them a personal story that happened with me once crossing the border from Canada. You know, he asked me, the border patrol officer asked me, how did you get your citizenship? And he had some sort of an attitude. and I told him, I got it from my mother. And he said, how did your mother got it? I said, she got it from her grandmother. My grandmother is a citizen. And he said, how did your grandmother get it? I told him, I really don't know. I haven't asked before. And he says, you know, it's like a snowball effect. And I didn't want to argue with him. I felt like he had a negative connotation to it. But when I left, I called my uncle and I told him, you know, how did my grandmother get her citizenship? And I come to know that actually the Bezzi family have very, very old roots.
They do. The first imam in Detroit. I mean, there were Bazis here in 1912. I mean, I have documents from people who, Khalil Bazzi, who was the first Shi'i sheikh in Detroit, he came and he Alixa Naf, another historian, recorded an interview with him in the 1980s. And he was old at that point, but she was talking to him about, you know, what happened when he got to Detroit. And he said, when he got off the streetcar at the intersection of Manchester and Woodward Avenue, which is right where that first Highland Park Ford factory was, the factory that he came here to work in, he got off the streetcar and he walked down the street. And he was so scared because he came here, his brother had made like a lapel pin for him to wear on his jacket when he got on the train in New York, that told the conductor, because he didn't speak in English, he needs to go to this stop and change trains, and then he needs to go to that, blah, blah, blah. But when he got to Manchester, it just said, get off the streetcar. And he didn't know how to get to his brother's house. And he got off the streetcar and he said, he was so happy. He looked around and he said, it was Arab, Kulum bin vintage Bale. You know, everybody was speaking Arabic. It was like, he felt like he was at home. So there was big community here. That was in 1912. And yeah, the Bazis were one of the first families here. And a lot of Bazis got their citizenship because many of them fought World War I. And then maybe they had children here. And at some point somebody went back to Lebanon.
Yeah,
but,
exactly. So
but
I
they
discovered...
had citizenship.
Right, I discovered that one of my ancestors here is a World War I veteran.
You see?
And actually it goes back to the 19th century, like the late 19th century, that one of them arrived here and then left, and then, you know, he kind of set the ground to come back, and with a long story that's like, I don't know if it's myth or fact, but it is a known story in the family. And uh, I uh, I all of a sudden grew, I felt I have deeper roots in my place. And I felt, I wish I knew that so I can share that with the officer. I probably have
my deeper... great-grandfather fought World War One. UMF. How about your great-grandfather? What was he doing? Yeah,
I mean, probably have deeper roots than him.
But, I mean, no one ever asked me that question. No one ever asked me how I got my citizenship. That's a loaded question.
Yeah. So, it took all the way that I was in my 30s for me to think about that question. I just wondered, like, why did I think before? I just feel that we grow in an environment that does not pay attention or puts importance on personal history and oral history. And I've been paying attention lately, and I've, you know, all of a sudden I've sunk into history. I became developed so much passion for history. But
have you read my book?
I'm sorry, I didn't. But
if you're into the history of the Muslim community here in Detroit, you got to read my book. That's what it is. It's a history.
You know what happened with me, doctor, is that I started to read about Arab American identity, and of course, mm-hmm. your books are on the subject. But when I started reading that, I felt I need to read more about Arab identity. Mm-hmm. Before I get to Arab American identity, I developed interest in Arab identity. I've been 2 years now in my research, and I'm writing also on Great. Arab identity. And actually, we're starting a program in the Arab American Center for Culture and Arts titled Arab Identity. I'm going to be hosting it starting very soon.
That's great. It's a great subject. It's a great subject.
Thank you.
But also, when you're collecting this archival material on the history of your family, and on the history of other families or other people in the community, please don't hold on to them yourself. Either give them to the museum or give them to the Bentley Archive in Ann Arbor, which also has an Arab American and even more of a Muslim American focus in its collection. So these are two really good archives. The Arab American Museum is telling a national story. The Bentley Archive is telling a Michigan focused story. But anything you're doing to collect this narrative, if you collect it and keep it yourself, then very often those things just go in the trash can. Right. If you're bothering to collect them and do it in a systematic way, please make sure it gets to an archive so other people can make use of it and have access to it.
Thank you. And this is a message to the community that if you have anything you feel or you're in doubt if it has any historical importance, please take it to the center for Arab American Studies. They will take care of it.
We'll help you. We'll help you.
Okay, sorry, deviated a little bit, Sally, but we're coming back to some, you know, to that personal story. So I'll start with this question, and then we'll dwell into other questions that we've developed as a tradition in this program. So during this pandemic, doctor, did you find yourself having a little bit more time?
Actually, I think that I'm unusual in the sense that I didn't, because when you're talking about the Halal Metropolis Project, and one thing that we did was we started doing these interviews, like when we were first trapped at home, we realized very quickly that, you know, everyone was talking about frontline workers, and we realized that people in the Muslim community were on every kind of frontline you can be on. They're medical workers, they're Uber drivers, a lot of people work in the food service industry, police officers, county sheriffs, technology specialists. I have one friend who works for a company that basically arranges the logistics of how products, like how the different parts of the auto industry get moved around for the on-demand production. And, you know, she's shifted to try, you know, her company shifted to trying to get PPEs here to Michigan and tests here to Michigan. So, she's a computer specialist who works in some dark room somewhere, but she was on the front line, you know. So we started interviewing people who were on the front lines and who were being affected, just kind of to do what you're doing here, but focusing really specifically on the Muslim community in Detroit and how it's being affected. So we started doing these interviews. That became very time consuming. During Ramadan, we also did a special project. We hosted a Ramadan lights contest, encouraging people to light their homes and giving awards at the end of the month. And that just kept us busy because, you know, I had a team of people out every night, like searching for houses, and the judges were doing their judges. And it was really fun. It kept me connected to people. I mean, I was connected online. I had to get WhatsApp for my phone. I had not had WhatsApp before, but now I feel like I'm a true Dearborn person because I have WhatsApp. Yeah. So in fact, I haven't had more time than I had before. In a way, it's like there's no end to work these days. It's kind of weird. So I think I'm probably one of the rare people who's in that position. And I'm fortunate, you know, because first off, I'm fortunate because I could still work at home. So I could still get my income and my health benefits. But I'm especially fortunate because my job is one that connects me to people. And so all this work that I'm doing is keeping me, you know, with people and helping prevent that sense of isolation that so many other people have. So it's been good for me to have this stuff to do.
Thank you, Doctor. And this answers the question of Alex Sharafuddin. What are some of the things that you're accomplishing staying at home during the pandemic? I guess it is definitely one of which is the Halal Metropolis shows that you've been doing online. We have another question here from Kathy Brown. She asks, what do you think the ideal outcome of this pandemic at a personal level and at a collective level?
These are big philosophical questions. I really struggle to think of, so in terms of what I'm trying to accomplish, like I have, in a way, my summer was robbed from me because I was planning to work on my book and really make some progress on my book this summer. And it was like, you would think that my exhibit being shut down and me being trapped at home, I would have more time to work on the book. But first off, with all the Halal Metropolis work being online, that was very time consuming. But now I'm having to plan for my classes in the fall to get them online. That's a huge amount of time. So it's like, I'm just trying to carve out like a little bit of space and all of this stuff that I'm doing so that I can actually make progress on my writing, because I do have several sort of things inside me that I need to get out. And really, I think talking about, so I'm working on an edited volume with several people called Uncertain Refuge, and it's about Dearborn, like kind of what's happened to Dearborn in the last 5 years, kind of in the Trump era, and how incredibly, how responsive Dearborn has been to this political period. It's not like that period right after 9/11. I think there was a lot of like quietness that happened in that period, fear, introversion. I think now we've kind of caught the opposite. People are just like, you can see it now with this Black Lives Matter moment, the Arab community, they know that Black Lives Matter and that the people in the Black community have to lead the resistance that's happening right now. So they're not trying to, you know, usurp anything from anyone, but they also know that their community has a history of anti-Black racism that they want to address. And I just see so much leadership and so much dynamism and so much very strong activism in the Arab community right now. So this is one of the things that we're trying to document and talk about. So, so I think at a social level, at a societal level, I think that we're really being pushed in a direction that is encouraging. It's just so clear that our healthcare system doesn't work. It isn't working for most of us, that our economic structure is not working for most of us. All these people unemployed, all these people without health care, the fact that we have a government that is irrational and can't even communicate honestly to our citizens, that we have a government that isn't putting us as American citizens first. It's stunning what is happening right now. The failures of this administration are just stunning. And it's easy for us to make fun of the president and his people. They're easy to make fun of. But the problem is a lot of this stuff is structural and systemic. And I'm just hoping that this crisis that we're going through and the utter, you know, collapse of our system, we were already sort of there were people who were really sort of pushing back against the government and seeking more progressive political candidates. It's kind of unfortunate that the primary ended right before this happened. I think if the primary had happened after this, we might have had a different outcome. But still, I just think that more, I think that Americans have, you can't hide anymore from our political crisis that we're in. And I hope that as a result of this pandemic and this shitstorm we're living through, I'm sorry, but I don't know what else to call it, that people will, we'll find the courage to insist on change. So I'm hoping that on a personal level, I have to say that I'm optimistic for us as a society. Personally, I'm just like, I'm struggling. It's not been easy. I mean, there's just so many uncertainties. And I think, you know, I really feel now that I'm aging, that I'm, you know, I don't know. I just feel like there are days when I really feel defeated by this situation we're in. I mean, I hope that I'll, you know.
I feel your expertise actually in this, what we're going through, is most important. The way you see things and the lens of your analytical history is very important in understanding what's going on and then putting some anchorship in what's going on with us. You know, the lack of leadership in our political atmosphere has created this sort of chaotic atmosphere. It feels polarized, feels different. I really I'm taken back by the tension and lack of balance and lack of vision that's taking place. But it's people like you who put really stability and put anchorship and put things in the right perspective to see. So I don't agree with you, Doctor. I feel that your role actually is becoming more important. Look at us now. Like our the Black Lives Matter movement is manifesting into a revision of history. You know, it's going back to history. So things, you know, are even with the pandemic. You know, when they had a lack of findings on medication or whatever, they went back to actually history. They went back to what happened in 1918, Spanish flu, and how did we react to it? Even using some methods that they've used at that time, like the transfusion of blood, etc. Doctor, I'm gonna lighten up the questions a little bit to end our program on a positive note. And this is really a strategy that I've been using myself since I have not much control over what's going on outside. I decided to actually focus internally and do produce as much as I can during this time. So I'm writing more and I'm focusing on family more and just doing more programming really that is pointed, you know.
That's awesome. More power to you. Everybody should be doing this. I'm trying. I think I'm transitioning between working on the Halal Metropolis material to working on my own material, and it's a hard shift. So if I sound, you know, I think that's what's going on.
All right. Hanan Yahya, she says, how do you heal yourself, doctor? Like at a personal level.
Hi, Hanan. I love Hanan. She's just an amazing activist. She's doing amazing work in the city. And, you know, all hail to you, Hanan, and everything you do. We need leaders like you. I don't have a good answer to that question. So I'll tell you what I do. What I like to do is I really like working in my yard. I landscape my yard with all native plants. Does not make me an anti-immigrant person, but I just use the plants that are indigenous to Michigan because they're better for the environment. And for years, I've been so busy in the summer that I haven't really been able to take care of my yard. And so this year it's like, I'm home and I have no excuse. And I had knee surgery a few years ago. My yard is very hilly. I couldn't work out there, but this summer I've been doing a lot of work in my yard. And I will tell you that is where I heal myself. Nothing makes me happier than being out there just weeding, planting new things. I got a bunch of plants from a local native nursery and I put in a bunch of new plants and I watched the weather like a hawk. Today it was beautiful and it rained and we had lots of weather. It's been kind of a little bit of a drought lately, so I obsess about the rain. But and it's good. It's physical activity. It gets me outside. It gets me outside of my own head. So that's probably my best therapy.
Awesome. And the Hadi from New York, he asks, what's the last epiphany or aha moment that you had? You know, sometimes you're reading something or you're thinking about something and you have this aha moment. Can you remember any aha moment you had lately?
Well, so I mean, my mother has been ill. My mother is 89 years old, and she was just hospitalized on Friday, and she's been very ill. And and she's in North Carolina. She's far away from me. I can't be there to take care of her. I have three siblings who are in the area, so that's good. And they have not been able to see her because she's in a retirement home. They have not seen her for 3 months. So in a way, this illness is like a blessing because she got to see them. And I think the aha moment I had is, it's not like I needed to be told how dependent I am on my siblings or how much they do, you know, like they take care of my mom and how much I appreciate them. But I think that just seeing all the little things that have gone into her care in these last few days and all the questions and just sort of watching like more closely than maybe I usually do. I think my big aha moment is that, you know, I'm so lucky to have all these siblings, these adult siblings who have my back like this. And
thank you, doctor, for sharing.
Yeah. And even like little things, like, I don't know, I've been having this, my mom and I have been having, I've been cooking like all the foods that that I grew up with just mm-hmm. because, you know, I don't know, I'm missing my mom.
Yes. That actually brings, I hope that she feels better. Amr Zahar, he asks, what food reminds you of your childhood? This is appropriately asked.
Exactly. A well-timed question. Mm-hmm. Well, so today I made really, really deep, deep Southern food, man. I mean, I made chicken and dumplings. I don't know if you've ever had chicken and dumplings. It is like crack, man. It is so good. It's such addictive Southern food. It's not the healthiest food in the world, but it's so good. Yeah, that's something that my grandmother used to make, and just talking to my mom the other day made me want it. But I grew up in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And so more than eating like traditional Southern food, I ate a lot of Cajun food. So at the first part of this pandemic, I was cooking red beans and rice, jambalaya, all these Southern dishes that you probably wouldn't even have heard of, all these Cajun dishes. And I actually, the week before the quarantine started, I was in New Orleans for spring break. So I was down there and I had a great, great time for that spring break. And I'm so glad we never go away for spring break. I'm so glad we went this year because mm-hmm. we had a little vacation before this whole thing started. But yeah, that's what I've been doing. Basically is cooking Southern food.
Great. I want to get to some recommendations, doctor, before, because we have a lot of questions left, but we're out of time. But I want to get some recommendations from you. You know, this time some people are having a little bit more time to read. Do you have a book recommendation?
Well, so in terms of fiction, I have a great pandemic book because it's a really long book. It's called The Children of Time by Adrian Chakowsky. And it's an awesome like science fiction book about basically terraforming, like humans go and they terraform other planets. And it's about this one situation where that kind of goes awry. But it is the most creative book. Chakowsky he was trained as a biologist. And so he understands like the evolution of different species. And so he evolves these species on this new planet. And it is the most amazing commentary on human society and the way societies evolve and the political culture of human societies and also how these other species evolve. It is really, it's a really cool book.
Interesting.
Children of Time.
The Children of Time.
Mm-hmm. Children of Time, yeah. And then for an academic book, mm-hmm. I was just sent a copy of a friend of mine's book called Argentina. Let's see, I have it right here. Argentina in the Global Middle East. And it's about Arab migration to Argentina and the relationship, sort of the historic relationship between people in Argentina and people in the Middle East. And it's a book that kind of overturns our ideas about migration and assimilation, because it talks about not just people coming and settling in a place, but all the movement, the ways in which people move back and forth and how their intellectual ideas and their artists and their material products moved around the globe. It's just a fascinating look at migration. Her name is Lily Balafe, and mm-hmm. it's an awesome book. It just came out.
Thank you, Doctor. And as far as shows, are you what show are you hooked up on?
I'm almost embarrassed to admit the most recent show. So we watch a lot of TV. That's the one thing that my husband and I both do. We binge TV shows. And the one that we binged during the pandemic, because we'd seen everything else, we had not seen Bosch, which is a police procedural show. And it's kind of like embarrassing to admit that I really, really enjoyed this police show right now in this pandemic. And it deals with some of the it deals with in a very indirect way. I think it kind of like it how can I say it? I usually don't watch police shows, but it put it this way, they're very critical of the unions, which we know police unions are really going the extra mile in protecting police, protecting bad cops. And it deals with racial tensions in the police force in a very creative way. I don't know. It was a good show, Bosch. Very Thank good you. Acting, very the, dynamic.
Since you see a lot of TV, Sally, what's your show recommendation? Do you have one that you want to recommend?
I think this is when it's late in the day. What show would I recommend? I mean, I liked, like The Sopranos, The Wire, those shows. I think if you want to watch a documentary, the one about James Baldwin was just awesome. His voice, it's amazing to make a documentary about a person who passed away, 30 years ago. And instead of using his friends and his family to tell the story, it uses his own words to tell the story. And he is so, all the issues that he talks about in terms of violence, police violence against African-American people, and just the racial inequities of our society, it's just a ringing condemnation of the way we live today, because so many of the issues that he wrote about 40, 50 years ago, they're still with us today, so many of those social problems. And it's amazing to hear him speaking in his eloquent, artful voice from the past. He's just an amazing writer and artist. And he's just condemning us. He's condemning us. It's amazing. I would definitely recommend that documentary. For some reason, I'm blanking on the name of it.
Yeah, it's fine. I think we've seen it all, and it's one of the shows on Netflix now. So
it is on Netflix now.
Yeah, if they look for James Baldwin, they'll find it. I don't want to go further, Doctor. I know it's late in the night, so.
Yeah, we went past our time.
We did.
Sorry about that. I talked too much. I was worried that an hour would be too long. And look at me. I just talk.
But as you know, it's Arabic tradition to go over time. And, not only that, but also to actually have a long conversation at the door, right? So in saying goodbye, we probably will have a few minutes. But before that, I just want to tell our audience that on next Tuesday, we're going to have Dr. Sadaf Jaffer. She's the mayor of Montgomery Township in New Jersey, the first actually Muslim American mayor in that area. So, and she's very highly educated and author. So we're excited also to have her next week. I'm trying to pick one of the questions that are left over, but maybe a light one. If you get to travel, I don't know if any travels were canceled for you with this pandemic, but what's the first country that you're going to visit after this?
Where I really want to go? I mean, I should say Jordan, because if I have any of my friends from Jordan are watching me, they'll be very upset if I don't say Jordan. I lived in Jordan for a while when I was younger, but I've never been to Lebanon. I would love to go to Lebanon. I know so many people who are from Lebanon. I know so many people who are in Lebanon. I feel like I've been to Lebanon. I think it's kind of like time for me to go to Lebanon. I've run out of excuses for why I haven't gone. I would like to go to Lebanon. I would like to tour the south of Lebanon. I would love to take my exhibit and show my exhibit in the south of Lebanon. I think it would be so much fun to let Lebanon look at Dearborn, you know, because it's not to do the whole Halal Metropolis thing, but to do the Dearborn part of it really specifically would be so much fun to show in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. So that's something I'll work toward, inshallah.
Yeah, and I'm sure you'll have tons of support and many excited people. I am one of them.
I'll rely on you when the time comes.
Yeah, to do an exhibit about Dearborn and Vintage Bell, that's reversing the magic.
Wouldn't that be fun? It'd be so much fun. Speaking of all this stuff, one quick note: did you notice the signs in Dearborn that said, you know, the I'm calling them the shawarma distancing signs? Did you see those signs?
Yes,
they took them down. They took them down.
No way. Why?
People got upset. Some people thought that it was like offensive, and they took them down.
Oh, come on!
I think we need to start a revolution. Bring us back our shawarma distancing signs.
Come on, what's offensive about them?
I don't know.
They're very appropriate, actually.
People, when I posted the picture on Facebook, several people wrote in and said that they thought it was offensive, and they didn't really say why. They just said, "This is offensive." I'm like, no, it's not.
It's a sense of humor, and it's marketing, actually.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, one of the signs says, you know, keep your the distance of a Model T, you know? So what could be more American and more Dearborn than the Model T, right? Shawarma is on the same level as the Model T. This is not an insult.
Yeah.
This is a celebration, you know?
Right.
So I want to get one of those signs and put it in my exhibit and take it to Beirut or to the Junoon.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. This is part of the exhibit. last question, I'm going to leave you with that, Doctor, if you had a magical closet in your bedroom that teleports you to a specific place every time, where would that place be?
Oh my goodness. have you read what's his name? Have you read the novel Exit West?
No.
What's his name? Mohsen Hamid is the author's name. He's a Pakistani writer, and he uses this device where you just these portals open up in your like in your wall or whatever, and you step through the portal. And then you're transported to some other place, but you don't get to pick. That's the thing. So it's kind of a crapshoot. You step through the door. Where do you go? You don't know. Can I have three portals?
I mean, since it's a fantasy question, I guess.
Okay,
you can have a portal that opens up to three portals.
One portal would take me to Dearborn because I live in Ann Arbor. And it's very frustrating to me that I live so far from Dearborn. I would like to have a portal to Dearborn so I could be in Dearborn whenever I want. And so that I could attend more events like the events that you host at the Arab American Museum and other events that happen in Dearborn. And so that I could do my grocery shopping in Dearborn and so that I could be in Dearborn. I obviously have longed to move to Dearborn for a long time, but it hasn't been possible. So one portal would be to the town of Blowing Rock, North Carolina, which is where I'm going in a few weeks. Where I've spent my summers, basically my whole life. My grandmother had a summer house there and it's still in the family. And that's where I'm going to be able to go and have my social distancing vacation in the mountains, which is very beautiful. That is where I truly find my peace, is in that place. It's so beautiful. And then I would have a portal to the village of Suesa in the kingdom of Jordan, so that I could keep in touch with the family that we live with there and that we feel so close to there. There, I've made my Jordanian family happy by mentioning this, but I really would. It would be so great if we could spend more time in Jordan. And it would be great if it was a two-way portal and some of our family and friends from Jordan had more of an opportunity to visit here. Don't let Homeland Security hear me say that. but we, for the first time ever this last summer, a member of the family that we lived with got a visa and came to the United States and spent his summer here, and we got to spend some time with him, and it was so much fun. And he was supposed to be here this summer, and unfortunately because of COVID he wasn't able to come back, but that was like one of our exciting things for this summer, is that we were going to get to spend more time with him. But anyway, so those are where I'd have my portals: to Dearborn, to the mountains in North Carolina, and to Jordan. How about you, where would your portal go?
Interesting. It would be to the beach somewhere, where you know, probably to my hometown of Tyre, in Lebanon, which is almost an island, and to one of its beautiful beaches.
Don Eunice was from Tyre, wasn't he? Did you know Don Eunice?
I didn't know him personally. I know him as a legend.
But he was from Tyre, wasn't he?
I'm not sure. Probably there is. We have Eunice in Tyre.
Yeah, so I think his family was from Tyre. Yeah.
Doctor, you insisting on three portals rather than one is a testimony to your generous soul. And all of your portals had to do something with people. And that's what you, that's a testimony to your personality and your connection to people. You have been a great asset to the city of Dearborn and to the Arab Americans. Thank you very much for all you do. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been really fun. And I don't usually talk about myself. I'm usually the interviewer, not the interviewee. So this has really been an inversion. I've enjoyed it very much. And thank you for all that you do. And I thank, you know, everybody who's listening. I look forward to hearing some of the other episodes, hearing what other people have to say. So thank you for doing this. And it's great that you're documenting this history. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Doctor. I have a copy of all these videos and audios on a hard drive. I'm planning years after to just hand you this drive, and so for you to archive. And
don't wait years after. Give it to me next time you see me, and I'll put it in the Bentley, and it'll have your name on it, and it'll be there forever.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
It has been an honor, Doctor. Thank you. Have a great night.
Thank you. Good night.